Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audible.com/Dan Carlin and get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership.
Fiercely independent, Dan Carlin. Common sense.
Anger, anger, anger. Look at the anger. Donald Trump just won the presidency 2 nights ago, by the way. This is the first show we've done since. We're going to talk about it, obviously, but I can't get over the anger. And we've talked about this in previous shows, right? I mean, the growing level of anger, the demonization of one's countrymen. I mean, if what we just saw 2 nights ago isn't a version or a spin-off of the Revenge of the Gangrenous Finger, I don't know what is. So this has obviously been stuff we've dealt with, and a lot of the program today will probably harken back to that. So if I say we've done shows on this before and you want to hear more, it's in the archive somewhere. Now, I knew I was going to be upset with the results of the election. I just didn't know exactly why. As a political Martian, you know, I wasn't going to be satisfied either way. So I knew I was going to come in here and grouse. But I gave it a 75% probability that I'd be grousing because Hillary Clinton won. I have acknowledged, though, that I have been wrong about Donald Trump multiple times during this campaign. So the fact that he surprised me again should come as no surprise. I gave him a 25 or 30% chance, and here we are. Kudos to Michael Moore, by the way. I hope he put some money on his prediction, as has been widely reported. Remember, he, a while back, said Donald Trump was going to win, and he listed all these reasons, and perhaps the most Nostradamus-like one of them referred to Trump's position on trade issues and his appeal to people in the so-called Rust Belt and up in that area because of the trade and job questions. And wow, he took them all. He took all those states. So we're in for some interesting times. And obviously some things are changing. Now, part of what I'm going to talk about today is going to be to emphasize how some of these changes, which we would not admit were happening unless they were right in front of our eyes, which of course they are, open up opportunities for good outcomes. Bad outcomes too, right? I mean, these are all forks in the road ahead of us, and there are ways that these things could be turned to positives and ways they could go to hell in a handbasket, right? So let's understand that. I'm going to try to be a little bit like a tracker here and say, I think this side smells right. Bear in mind and take with a grain of salt, though, that that's usually the side I always think smells right. Let's do some analysis here and see if we can break some of this down. There are some hard truths here people need to absorb, because if you don't absorb them, this is going to happen to you again. The first hard truth is that the Democrats chose, and she made it through the process, their preferred candidate for the election, who is Wall Street preferred and a Washington, D.C. insider, who's liked by that town and the whole thing. In other words, they put forward an establishment candidate in an anti-establishment election. This is not necessarily always suicide if the candidate is really strong in certain other respects. Unfortunately for Hillary Clinton, it wasn't in the respects that her campaign touts. I mean, what was it they said about her all the time? The most prepared presidential candidate in history, registered trademark. Whether that's true or not, that wasn't what counted in this election. Hillary Clinton was a bad presidential candidate, and everyone who could see it for what it was knew why. Because she's unpopular. Because a lot of the electorate just doesn't like her. And people would explain that away. Big fans would say, well, that's just right-wing investigations taken. I mean, there would be a lot of excuses, as though any of it mattered at all. 2 days ago, we did not have the proverbial popularity contest for president. We had an unpopularity contest, and Hillary Clinton won. And I would suggest to you that that is something that everyone should have seen as a major possibility. There's a lot of finger-pointing from the Democrats on, you know, to other people for allowing this to happen, this result to happen. Well, maybe you should take a look in the mirror and ask what it was about your system of choosing candidates that allowed one of the most unpopular presidential candidates in history to be your choice. How can you prevent that from happening again? Asking that question is the most important things that people who are ardent Democratic Party faithful should be asking themselves today. How do we prevent that from happening again? Because if you do that, it's going to force a long look at your process. You know, I've heard from some people who say, I don't know what you're complaining about, Dan. They have these candidates. If you want to run, you put your name in the hat, then you are voted on by the Democratic faithful, and Hillary is who they picked. That's ignoring a lot of internal stuff that goes on in both parties. First of all, the people that run the parties are often intimately connected to some of the people running. Case in point, the people running the Democratic Party are very close to the Hillary Clinton folks, and the ways that the thumb can be pressed down on the scales to aid her, well, those ways were used. To take just one example, how about the superdelegates in the party? And for those who know the party's history, and we've done shows on this, the superdelegates, the so-called superdelegates themselves, made up of party faithful, ex-legislators, current legislators, lobbyists, those folk are supposed to exist to keep the Democratic rank and file from nominating people who have no chance of winning. And almost all of them broke for Hillary Clinton. The people she was up on stage with initially at the primaries, did you think it looked like one person who was a big shot and a bunch of people no one had ever heard of before? That's not always accidental. Sometimes there's years of discussions between camps saying, now, don't run this year. It's Hillary's year. I mean, these things happen. They're documented forever and ever and ever in both parties. This is internal party dynamics that go on between elections when most normal human beings are going about their daily lives. Not all of us work for a political party. When you do, there's all kinds of internal things like you would imagine at any other large company, business, or whatnot entity. The Democratic Party, and many people have talked about this, greased the wheels for Hillary Clinton this year. And they were able to put their finger on the scale when it came to the primary elections, influence what Democratic voters had to choose from and how they voted, somewhat. Almost got a little upset by that Bernie Sanders thing, though, didn't you? But they couldn't do that in the general election. And so the candidate that the wheels were greased for gets beaten in a time when if she'd really had to fight against other heavyweights, she wouldn't have won the primaries and you would have had a better candidate. I don't think I'm out of line with suggesting that if you put a halfway decent Democratic candidate without her unfavorability rating, they can be a zero, not even a positive, just not her unfavorability rating, you win the election 2 days ago against Donald Trump, because then he becomes the greater evil to a lot of people that saw Hillary Clinton as the greater evil. Whose fault is that? If this were a publicly traded corporation, the shareholders would have every right to revolt and say, get every person in the leadership out of here and start changing the rules so we don't end up with this kind of result again. There are some positive benefits to what the Democratic Party is going through right now. And it is something you see sometimes after big soul-searching losses over U.S. history from either party. Sometimes you see the party remake itself, and we've done whole shows on this too. But this would be a good time for the Democratic Party to do that. To do that is not easy, by the way, because the people who are the power brokers in the party now will not go quietly. It's not like they're going to get up there and go, yeah, I'm going to leave, sorry. No, they have to be ousted. And the shock and the anger and the disbelief so many Democratic faithful feel today provides a wonderful emotional impetus to help turn the page on the last era of Democrats. And there's a wonderful historical symmetry to it, because as Hillary Clinton sort of leaves the political stage here, this is a wonderful coda to the end of that last era. I mean, if you open up a history book 100 years from now, they're going to call the period from late 1980s, certainly by 1992, the Clinton era in the Democratic Party. You had Clinton's rise, his part of the cabal of Democrats leading the Democratic Leadership Council and the change in Democratic strategies. Then you have two terms with him. Then his vice president, Al Gore, becomes the standard bearer in an election. Then you have this John Kerry thing. And then in 2008, Hillary Clinton is the Once again, the she's coronated was the way the media called it at the time. It was going to be a fait accompli. And then this little-known Illinois first-term senator came out of nowhere, Barack Obama, and upset the apple cart. That was, by the way, a wonderful early warning sign that should have been taken more note of at the time, that as a national candidate, she had perhaps terminal deficiencies. Nonetheless, the wheels were again greased in 2016, and now we know what happened, so she's on her way out, and the Clinton years are sort of, at least in terms of the elected officials, coming to an end. Now, as we said, you have to sort of oust her people, too. If you're going to have another remaking of the party, and these things happen periodically in U.S. history for both parties, you have to basically say it's time for the Donna Brazils and the Debbie Wasserman Schultzes and all those people in the party to pack their bags, and they can move off into political punditry and all that, too. They could do a podcast. But new blood is needed, and it's time for the Democratic Party to change course. Now, as far as the direction to change course, well, I think that's something that we'll be talking about in future shows as things unfold, assuming that there's any course change at all, and always assuming that there's any course change beyond just, you know, cosmetic stuff. We always have to account for a political system that would much rather sort of change the marketing strategy rather than the actual performance, but we'll watch that as it unfolds. My only advice in terms of broad directions, I'd look for your course change ideas, if you're asking this tracker up at the fork in the road up ahead, which way smells best. If I were you, I'd go back to something that was much more a part of the Democratic way of looking at things before the Bill Clinton era, before the Democratic Party sort of aligned themselves with high-flying corporate moguls more than, blue-collar workers. I would suggest a little injection of populism would be to the benefit of the party and the country. Populism, of course, is a weird thing when you think about it. I mean, it essentially means, you know, trying to appeal to the needs, desires, and points of view of the common people a little bit more, right? If you have your elites in politics, appealing to the people that aren't those elites would be a populist way of looking at things. But populism is like a vitamin that you need, but that you could overdose on, maybe like a vitamin A. It's one of those things that you kind of have to monitor your levels with. Because if you don't have enough of it, well, I think you could argue that the result from two nights ago is an example of what happens if you don't have enough of it. You get a strong injection, maybe more than you like. You start mainlining populism. And if you have too much of it, well, some of the worst mass movements in human history have essentially started out with a populist sort of appeal. So you have to be careful. It helps to be able, instead of having to get a giant dose of this as sort of the pendulum swinging backwards, it helps if you could get a nice steady, you know, stream all along. Get enough vitamin A so you don't have the problem, but not so much that you overdose. If I'm looking at where the system is missing something now, a party that had a nice mainstream, you know, constant feed of methadone when it comes to populism would be beneficial for balance. That's the direction I would suggest. But as I said, that particular path in the road always smells pretty good to me. So let's examine our president-elect. We'll start with one of the aspects I think is the most interesting in this whole thing. Trump is the first non-politician to win the White House since 1952. That was the year, of course, that as a Republican, General Dwight Eisenhower won the White House. He would serve two terms. Obviously, his previous job was as general, and at the time, he was actually something that they called the General of the West. Sometimes he kind of was, you know, if you had the Soviet Union on one side, you had us on the other with all of our allies, and the guy who was formulating the military policy was General Eisenhower. They often said that he kind of sometimes thought becoming president was like a step down in responsibility. Trump, of course, is a businessman. Both generals and businessmen would seem to me to have a danger attached to both of them. They are accustomed to getting their own way and being able to move mountains and get things done. And now they're moving into a system that has roadblocks that have been placed in the way of doing that deliberately. Sometimes speed bumps, sometimes outright firewalls. Now, normally, I like a good constitutional confrontation, but only if I'm sure of victory. I'm not so sure in the climate we have now that the Constitution would win out on some of this stuff, so I'd rather not have the confrontation to begin with. It makes me a little nervous, or a lot nervous, to have one of these people that has an authoritarian strong man, I'm the only guy who can get things done, sort of vibe to them in an era where the Constitution already seems kind of, you know, been down twice, three knockdown rule, already on the ropes again, take it easy, right? I don't want to see him hit again. I think we should make a distinction at the outset here between what maybe we could call Trumpism or Trumpist and something that would have been probably apparent if the GOP won the election, regardless of who it was. I mean, we do know that the Republicans now control the House, the Senate, and the White House, the trifecta, the much desired, especially for a first-term president, trifecta. Doesn't happen very often. It's a wonderful position for the Republicans to find themselves in, and there's a lot of people freaking out about that. So it's worth making a distinction between people that are upset about things that are pretty unique about Trump himself and stuff that would have been in play regardless if the GOP won the White House. For example, I'm hearing a lot of people, you know, losing their mind over possible Supreme Court nominees during Trump's administration, but I would suggest to you that anybody who had won the Republican nomination would probably put Supreme Court justices on at least as conservative as Trump. And remember, one of the things about Trump that is kind of whispered quietly that a lot of people are aware of is that he's not as conservative as he's selling himself, and he's probably not as conservative as most of the people he was up against in the GOP primary. The weird thing to say here, and I may say these kinds of things a few times in my Trump analysis, is that Trump may have been the best person if you were going to get a Republican victory in terms of the Supreme Court nominees you get. Let that sink in for a minute. So some of these things that have people losing their minds about Trump are not specifically about Trump. They're about the GOP taking the White House for the first time in 8 years. And I have to remind myself that there's a whole group of young people that have grown up not even knowing in sort of a memory sense a Republican occupant in the White House. So maybe I'll cut some slack for that. But let's remember, some of this is about Trump and some of it is just about, oh my God, the Republicans are in the White House again. And oh my God, they've got the House and the Senate too. Remember, to me, as a person who, for example, cares deeply about civil liberties, something which, by the way, when I was a kid, Democrats did a lot of, not so much anymore. Look at Dianne Feinstein. It's a travesty. But as a person who cares about that kind of stuff, Republicans and Democrats both suck to me in that respect. I mean, like, look at secrecy, for example. Are you more afraid of Trump in terms of spying and Fourth Amendment stuff and secrecy? Or are you more afraid of Clinton? I mean, she's like the queen of secrecy. Isn't that just like a toss-up there? So on some of these issues, I sit there and go, okay, equally bad. Now, I have a theory about Trump, and it concerns how deeply he feels these things that he ran on. I have to take the man at his word initially, because what else do you have to go on with people in politics? As we've said before, you have less protection guarding your interest as a voter from a politician promising you something and not delivering than you do in a handshake deal with a guy who offers to mow your lawn. So nothing's holding Trump to this at all. But here's what he said during the campaign he was basically for or would do or favored. We'll go down a list here. Some of these things, by the way, you're going to find probably, but not certainly to your chagrin, that I don't necessarily disagree with Trump on. He has some things about him that are pretty common things for third-party candidates to have, which is what makes him kind of unusual. That's what I mean, a Trumpism versus a standard GOP thing. Some of the things that are Trumpisms are things that third-party candidates from across the political spectrum have been advocating for years. If Trump actually follows through with some of his foreign policy ideas, that's stuff that Jill Stein and Gary Johnson both favor, right? So some of this stuff is from a third-party standpoint or an independent candidate standpoint, interesting, because Trump really kind of is a third-party or independent candidate dressed in Republican clothing. The question for Republican voters now is, does Trump maintain these positions or does he morph into a standard Republican? Start with the stated positions. We just mentioned the foreign policy. That's key. That's huge. That's unusual. Americans normally do not have a chance to weigh in on a change of direction in foreign policy because of something, as you know, called the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. It's one of those little flaws in our system where if the Democrats and Republicans essentially agree upon something, you have no ability to change that, because who are you going to vote for that has a chance of winning that has a different opinion? Trump's the first guy to get in the White House in my lifetime that at least says he doesn't buy into the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. That's huge. That's a very big deal. What does that mean? I think there's a lot of foreign leaders going, what does that mean? Well, join the club. He has spoken out against what I always like to call hyper-interventionism, because the other side always calls it isolationism, which makes no sense at all. I'm only asking for a foreign policy closer to the rest of the world. How can the rest of the world, by definition, be isolationist? Hyper-interventionism describes us better, and that doesn't make the position of the other side look quite as unassailable, does it? Well, Trump says he speaks out against stupid wars, makes it sound like we're not going to do that anymore. Americans, by the way, have been voting for that course of action for elections. Elections. They just don't get it. Does anybody remember George W. Bush running as a compassionate conservative and advocating and offering and promising a more humble foreign policy? Well, he's just one of many. Presidents do not run in this country on a more activist, interventionist foreign policy. They just don't. They often do run on the opposite, though. They just don't deliver. Because Trump is an outsider, there's this feeling that he can be trusted to deliver where our politicians have over and over and over again promised but failed. We've always used the very tired, and I'm sorry to bring it up again, you know, idea of Lucy from the Charlie Brown comics, who holds the football for Charlie Brown, and every time he kicks it, she pulls it away, and every time she has a new reason to get him to believe he's going to kick it, but he never can. When you look especially at the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party too, the amount of anger that their own party has at their electorate for completely promising one thing. First of all, getting them whipped up about the importance of something, then getting them to vote for it on it, and then not delivering. They're mad as hell. They don't trust any of those people. They call them rhinos, among other things. Part of the reason you have a Trump Republican Party is because you jobbed your own voters over and over and over again. You know why? Because there's a disconnect between you and they. You need a little populism. You need to get out of those fancy cars and those dinners and those, you know, meetings that you have with people who are just like you, and realize the country's in trouble, and see if you can figure out a way to make people continue to give you money for re-election while at the same time giving the people who are voting for you trying to make two ends meet something to help them make two ends meet. I'm sorry, that populist thing appeals to me, especially when we're obviously so deficient at a few things. Now, when we're talking about foreign policy, I can't help but bring in the whole Russian question as it refers to Donald Trump, because, of course, there's this idea, and it may be true, I'm not ruling this out, actually, that Trump and the Russians may have, you know, some connection between each other, working behind the scenes. Who knows? I mean, it's happened before. Anybody remember Ronald Reagan's October surprise with the Iranian hostages and all that? I mean, this stuff happens. All's fair in love and war and politics, right? Ask Richard Nixon. But the point is that I've never been as bothered by most people about this whole thing, because my attitude on the whole thing is, what the hell are we allowing tensions to increase with places like Russia and China to begin with? That's not good policy. It's weird in this country where we can, and maybe it's just a great power thing, I'm not specifically saying it's something unique to us, but we like to rub up against them in ways where we sort of rub elbow. I mean, we're not trying to be overly friendly. Look, and as I've said before, it takes two to tango. The Russians are doing stuff too. But if Trump is saying, let's have a better relationship with Russia, that sounds good to me. Does it mean you say, hey, as part of our better relationship, why don't you just have Latvia? No, we're not going with stuff like that. But the point is when you have the ability to destroy each other's country from the mid-range population cities on up to your capital and everything in between, you know, in an afternoon, don't be stupid. So in that sense, I think Trump is saying something that the establishment hates hearing, because let's be honest, there are some real world benefits to some people if there are tensions with other big countries. There are real world advantages to people if there are tensions with small countries, individuals. I mean, we have an entire industry now that's devoted to an ongoing war that unless somebody figures out an end point that doesn't exist now, there's no way to end. This is 1984. This is a war all the time. This is a young group of people growing up with no memory of anything else other than war all the time. If we had a politician in the White House who didn't just acknowledge that, because to his credit, Barack Obama did, not at the very beginning, not in any sort of meaningful way that actually made sense, but he said it in public and mentioned it, and it was a very big day. I think we did a show about it. If we had a president that actually looked at that and said, that's crazy, we have to figure out a way out of this, that's big, folks. Donald Trump's not my guy. Don't like Donald Trump. Scared to heck. And I'm going to point out more ways how. But I think a policy that says, let's diffuse tensions with other great powers and stop getting in their way and stop messing with them, and maybe they'll stop messing with us, is a good idea. I think being angry with these people serves no legitimate purpose. Which brings me to the third part of the foreign policy question, which has to do with global leadership. Was reading my Charles Krauthammer column because it gets my blood boiling, and sometimes I need that. He's talking about how enough Americans just don't care about America's global leadership role. What that means, folks, is how we have to have a U.S. command on every continent in the world and 160, 70, 80 bases around the world, how we have to be the global policeman, and it's all part of the American responsibility. Except that Americans don't want that, and they consistently vote against that. That's what that humble foreign policy of George Bush's was about. And so when he throws that stuff out that he's just kind of appalled that we just won't embrace this global leadership role, it's because we've done the cost-to-benefit ratio. And we realize that while some people do benefit from that role, people will say to me, Dan, if we give up the global leadership role, well, you can kiss the dollar as the reserve currency goodbye. Okay. So I'm weighing, right? I mean, there's a lot of people in the United States that want to know what's in it for them. Because if there's blowback, they pay the price. When there's a bill, they pay that. If they need their son to go fight in a foreign war, I'm sure there's a lot of Americans, and they've been doing this now for a long time, who are saying, now exactly what's in it for us with this whole global policeman thing? So Donald Trump has tapped into a vein, and I got news for you. Bernie Sanders was mining that same vein because it's a popular vein. And if we have a choice, we choose the side Charles Krauthammer doesn't like, which is why with a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy, you usually don't get that choice. Bingo. For me, that's a third-party thing I've wanted for a long time. Donald Trump's the first guy who's gotten into office promising that, where maybe you could go, let's see what happens. Which brings us to the next thing. See, Donald Trump's good parts are going to be front-loaded here. So trade policy. That Michael Moore column where he predicted a Donald Trump victory, that focus that he had on trade policy was damning, wasn't it? And he says he's going to bring the jobs back. We will see, right? I mean, there's a lot to the follow-up questions. What kind of jobs are we talking about also? How do you deal with robotics? Globalization's very important in other respects. I mean, there's a lot of devil in the detail things here, right? And people will often say to me, because I happen to be against the trade deals too and have been for 30 years, they'll say, well, are you against free trade, Dan? And absolutely not. But you have to understand that these trade deals are about so much more than that. And a key component of them was getting down the wages of the countries that were the richest in the world, especially the wages for the average people. It's part of what plays into why we have had the lowering of living standards in this country from the middle class downward. It's because the jobs they used to do pay a lot less because they're competing with a global labor pool. And you may say, well, what do you do about that, Dan? That's just the iron law of wages and supply and demand and all that. Well, we can talk about what you might do, but let's understand that these trade deals are a very large part of how that came about. So when Donald Trump complains about them and the people in these places that used to have higher wage jobs than they do now respond to that, that is something that neither Republicans nor Democrats have found it easy to tap into because, again, the trade policy of this country is broadly supported by the establishment of both parties, not Bernie Sanders, though. So once again, the populist candidates from both the Democrats and the Republicans were on the same page, and I'm on the same page with them, on the need to re-examine trade the same way we want to re-examine foreign policy. And the people that lost this election are the ones who have the points of view that have dominated for years, decades. The third thing on my list to examine of Trump's promises, I just put in parentheses, America first. It's an interesting idea. It also has to do with both the trade idea and the foreign policy changes. So we've talked about those specifically, but also in a larger sense, what Trump is trying to appeal to, whether or not he really believes it, is the disconnect. There's a disconnect, as we know, between you know, what the elite in this country, again, for lack of a better word, and the average American's lives and realities and expectations and situations are. And when Trump says that, people think that he's saying somebody's going to look and see what we're going through and what our lives are like and see things from outside the bubble. We are desperate for that. And the real problem is if you elect somebody from outside the bubble, it's not too long before they're in the bubble too. Doesn't take a long time to adapt really nicely to the bubble apparently either. So the idea that people might be looking at the concerns and situations regular Americans find themselves in and point out that if it's a trade-off between what the people in this country need and a trade-off between what the people in the other country get, I'm going to put my hand on the scale that favors our side. I'm sorry, that's a winning message in just about every country in the world. Number four on my list is something I haven't heard as much about since Trump started the whole taking of PAC money the way he did. But early on, do you remember how much he talked about corruption and money in politics, which is, of course, one of my favorite issues? Remember he was saying, I should know, I'm the guy who buys these people. Remember that whole line of argument? I haven't heard it as much anymore. But if he would actually come through on that, wouldn't that be interesting? This is, by the way, part of what we're going to get into in a little bit about how now that Trump has won the election, so many of these third-party positions that I like so much put him at odds with the Republican House and Senate he's just inherited that normally would be the greatest thing in the world for a new president to control the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. Except Trump disagrees with them if he sticks to these positions on a lot of key points. So more on that in a minute. Number five on my list is infrastructure. Every chance he gets, Trump is dropping the word. Excuse me, President Trump. President-elect Trump. Sorry. Wow, it's going to be a while. Dropping the term infrastructure. Again, it's a good term to drop because if you go around the world and look around, you're used to thinking of the United States as sort of the leading country in the world, not in infrastructure. Ours looks like it's fallen apart. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. And because of that, by the way, Democrats, Republicans, Trump's third party, everybody is saying, well, I'll save infrastructure. I'll get on infrastructure. We'll really put a lot in infrastructure. So it must be an obviously important point. No one wants to raise the taxes necessarily to pay for it if that's required. But everybody understands infrastructure is a winning political issue. And truthfully, it's something we really need. Number six on my list is ISIS and the war on terror. More on this in my next section when I talk about the really scary things about Donald Trump. Next on my list and somewhat related is the topic of Muslims. Trump has, and I divide this into sort of three groups. We have our American Muslims as one, Muslims from other countries who might want to come here as refugees or immigrants, and finally, Muslim states. Let's start with there. Trump has said basically that he's going to get tougher on the so-called, you know, the fountainheads of radicalism, the Saudis, some of the Gulf Emirates, and sort of try to shut down the radical ideology sort of at the source. If he does that, by the way, not only will that be interesting and anti-establishment, again, I think I'd be for that too. The Muslims via immigration. Well, this gets over, and I have this farther down on my list under the idea of immigration. So I think I'll deal with that in a second. And finally, as far as the Muslims at home, our American Muslims, this is a place where we have to be very careful, I think, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think it would be hard, and I don't think we are that far from the ideas that we treated the Japanese with in the Second World War. And I know that there's some of you listening that would think that that was just fine, by the way, under the right circumstance. But you have another terror attack in this country, if it's a big one, another two or three if they're small ones, and it would not surprise me for somebody to start looking at American Muslims as something we could start violating constitutional things for because of the threat, imminent danger, or whatever you wanted to say. This is something to be very careful of and to listen to our president carefully. There's a part of me, by the way, just let me say as a sort of an asterisk right here, I think he's going to moderate a lot of this stuff now. I could be wrong, and I certainly have been every step of the way, so don't listen to me. But I think some of this was for public consumption. We'll see. More again on this later. And finally on my list here is immigration and the wall. And he's promised to, well, he's got multiple promises on that. I mean, the head of the Republican Party, Priebus, yesterday said nobody has to worry about mass deportations, already starting to calm the storm and blunt the hard edges off some of these campaign promises. The issue with immigration and Trump is obviously inflammatory. He has stated before he wants to do like what Dwight Eisenhower did in the 1950s and round them up and send them back. But at other times he said, we're only going to go after criminals. A lot of other countries are being asked, their leaders are being asked what they think of Trump, and they can't figure out what to think because there's no continuity necessarily on some of this stuff. He doesn't stick to the same story, so you don't know what is truth and what is today's version. What Trump's going to find out, and it's been a part of every other major bill in the last, 30 or 40 years on immigration, is that you have a big difference between trying to keep people from coming over and how much the public will support that, and trying to deal with people that are already here and firmly entrenched and illegal. That's why all of the previous plans included amnesty as part of it. The idea was you have to sort of start from zero. Let's legalize these people, make them go through the process. We'll start from zero, and then we'll keep them from coming in. Then your next problem is keeping them from coming in because it's impossible. I don't see anything constitutionally inhibiting if Trump wants to build his wall. I think it's mistaken. I think they'll get through. I think, you'll have tunnels. I think you'll have migrants dying. I mean, I think there'll be a lot of things. But from a constitutional standpoint, to me, that's not the sky falling. I think it might fall economically in some of these states that border Mexico. And I think he might hear from his own Republican big donors about how they don't like this. And the economic challenge in those places could be severe. But that's not something. If you say you want to end illegal immigration, you can't really say that the guy's a fascist. That's just enforcing the laws. So, I mean, again, I think the mass deportations thing is sort of the line in the sand here. I don't think that that's the kind of thing most Americans are going to go for. I think that's the part that I would have a problem with. But if you're saying we're just going to make sure no one comes over the border that isn't doing it legally, I find it hard to disagree with that. The devil's in the details. We will see. I think, like I said, that this will be moderated by the economic forces in the American Southwest as soon as the impact of that is felt. Okay, now I have a list that I wrote that I sketched out while I was watching the returns come in two nights ago. And it was increasingly showing, Trump doing well and then eventually taking the lead. And then eventually you started to go, well, this guy's going to win this thing. I have a piece of paper I call the Mussolini Worries. And there's an asterisk I wrote at the top that says, this is when it becomes actionable. And I underlined actionable. And what I mean by that is that's when we have to get on the streets. That's when we get to have a collective freak out and do something collectively about it to save our democracy, right? There are moments like that. But you have to kind of draw a line in the sand and say, okay, this is objectionable. I don't like this. This is bad, but this is too far. And we may all have different ideas where the line should be, but we should have some no matter what, this is too far lines. On my list, again, this is just written in no particular order. I wrote press freedoms. Trump has said at certain times that the press has too much freedom to libel, slander, this, that. I think we can all understand how much it would affect all of us, regardless of your political point of view or how you feel about the president or the parties or anything. We all benefit from press freedom, and the only people who really don't like it are the people that are being written about. If that's not you, I would think that you would also think that anybody who discussed limiting the freedom of the press to tell you something should be told in no uncertain terms that that's a bridge too far in terms of our liberties. It's a First Amendment thing, right? If you care about the Constitution, you're not out there proposing limits on too much of the freedom of the press. I mean, obviously, back 200 years ago, 240 years ago, they had limits we probably wouldn't like today. But by the current modern standard, if he messes with the First Amendment, we should be getting out in the streets. Number two on my list was constitutional protections. This is kind of key, and it's not likely to involve a lot of Trump supporters, but you have to look at what you might call vulnerable communities in this country. We talked about Muslims a minute ago. These are people that are in a position that's very difficult and you have to have some sympathy for because it could happen to anyone and has happened to many groups over time. Not in this country, but I mean in the world. You get put into one of these groups, even if you say to yourself, listen, Dan, you know, the Japanese weren't out there conducting acts of terrorism that blew things up and killed people. That's what we're having happen with Muslims. Yes, but not guilty people should not be treated as though they've done something. This becomes the problem always, right? How do you treat the people who haven't done anything? If you treat them as guilty, we have a constitutional problem. We should all see the danger in that. By the way, if you fall for the oft-repeated line that we're only going to do it to this one group, then you're falling for something we've already been, you know, damaged by over time. We're just writing this law for this one specific incident, folks. It's called legal creep. Don't go there. It should be a hard red line in the sand for all of us. Torture is the next thing on my list. You know my opinion on this if you've ever heard this show. To me, it is unequivocally evil. It is what separates the societies that are worth supporting from those that are not. And you may argue with me over what is and what is not torture, but remember, Donald Trump is on record as having said waterboarding and a lot more. He may not stick to that, but I should point out, and for those of you who think that that's a particularly Trumpist point of view, if he decided to do that, he would simply be doing what the last Republican administration in power did. Let that sink in. I think if we're torturing people, we're on the wrong side. I'd get out with signs in the street with that, and I'd be calling for investigations. Next, I wrote discrimination, internment camps, religious freedom. That's the other thing about the Muslim thing I'd be really careful about if you happen to be a religious person, is that that is a First Amendment religious question. Be very careful of that line if I'm you. I mean, think about how another administration that was trying to think a little bit differently than that might use that same line of thinking. If you are a conservative Christian, believe it or not, you are just as vulnerable long-term to something happening under the same sort of rationale as Muslims are today. Let that sink in. Think about that for a minute. Protect your fellow Americans' rights, because if you don't, you will establish a path that eventually leads to you. That is a as-remembered sort of pseudo-quote from somebody. But it's a long-understood element of freedom. I mean, you have to allow the same rights you want to other people, or you establish the mechanism to take yours. And of course, there are the issues relating to things that Trump supporters would call political correctness. Other people would call things like discrimination, gross racism, sexism, misogyny. I mean, fill in the blank. There's a lot of things attached not just to Trump, but to a segment of his followers that's very nasty indeed. I mean, I'm one of those people that I can usually see the opinions and points of view of other people, but people like racists and whatnot, it's absolutely foreign. And I did get an email a while back from, I think it was a Swede, who tried to explain to me that he's probably a racist. And he said, here's why. And he went into being angry about people coming to his country and not respecting the laws. And I understood that, but I wasn't sure that that's the definition of racism that I'm working with here. I think the kind of racism I'm talking about is the stuff you see online that is very open, comparing people to animals. I mean, just, it's beyond the pale. What's that line about pornography that a Supreme Court justice is supposed to have used? I'll know it when I see it. Well, there are things where I can sit there and go, I can understand a person feeling that way. You know, don't come to my country and commit these crimes and follow the law when you do. And people saying, you know, get those damn gorillas. I mean, there's the stuff you see online is not just poisonous. And anybody that would call that stuff just, it's just political correctness run amok. It's not. It's gross. And so when we talk about a president who would wink and nod at that sort of stuff, I don't even know what to say about that. Those are the kind of things that would have put him off my list regardless. It is the one part of the Trump phenomena that I really don't understand at all. I can't sit up here and analyze it like I'm doing with the rest of these things, because that makes no sense to me. As I've said in earlier shows, I really, really, really thought that the whole racism thing was permanently moving in another direction. And along with predicting Trump doing well in elections, apparently, we're going to put that in the category of things Dan Carlin was wrong about and is still shocked about. And I have no idea where any of this goes in the next several years. And I don't know how to fix it. And I think that anybody that would actively get up there in politics and stoke this needs to be held accountable for it. Because once again, it's poisonous and it pulls us apart. The next thing on my list is nuclear codes. Well, I would suggest that already we have a terrible, weird, leftover, hangover reality when it comes to nuclear codes. The idea that that's in the hands of a single person anyway is mind-boggling. Remember, the excuse for this has always been that you have such a narrow window of debate. I mean, the idea that you might have 6 or 8 or 12 minutes to make a decision to launch a counterstrike imposes all sorts of limitations on your ability to consult with other people, right? We understand that. I have to believe, and I've said this before, it would be super duper massive, double extreme, top secret, but I have to believe that there are other people that are likely to have a say-so on this. I just don't know who they would be, and I don't know, you know, what the protocol would be, but it boggles my mind to think that any single figure could actually have that power. They might. But I have no ideas on the nuclear code. I just think Donald Trump with the nuclear code is quite a bit more scary than other people. And I think that it once again highlights the next problem on my list, which is we may now get a chance to at least have significant fears of the imperial presidency and the powers that we put in its hands over the last generation or three. There are all these things the president can do, especially in foreign policy now. The nuclear codes are a perfect example that have been the kind of things that sound very scary in the wrong hands, but they haven't been in the wrong hands yet. Well, let's just say they haven't been in the really wrong hands yet. Is Donald Trump the really wrong hands? I don't know. He's just the best suspect we've seen so far for that to be possibly the case. Does it make you rethink things? I mean, the president can start bombing a country by himself, ladies and gentlemen. Think about that, too. That boggles my mind. And remember also that that is not what your Constitution says, clearly and plainly. There's another good place right there for the Democratic Party to change their pivoting to go away from the Clinton years. How would you like a party that proposed fixing that kind of stuff? I'd be into that. Okay, so those are my Mussolini worries. Let me suggest that while any one of those is possible, you know, when you think about that, that's scary enough, but let me suggest why this might go a different direction. And I'll tell you what my evidence for it is, and you can weigh it for yourself and decide what you think. When Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, I got in trouble with a lot of you for a post-election show we did, where I congratulated the president and then said, but you're not going to get what you think you're going to get. And I based it on the only thing that you can actually judge a president-elect on in terms of policy, because obviously they haven't had any power, they haven't been able to do anything, and a guy like Trump, who hasn't been in government at all, has no governmental track record to show you what he's really like. So you base these things on the people that they begin to consider for positions in their government, cabinet posts and whatnot. And when Barack Obama started bringing in people that were simply the people left over from the previous Democratic administration, which is pretty common, by the way, but he was just sort of bringing in the old Clintonites to sit with him, you knew right there, okay, it's not going to be as different as he says. He's bringing in the same essential bureaucracy for himself that the last Democratic administration had. Now, if he had brought in really different people, you would have gone, wow, you know, most of these people have never been in government before, or they're really low-level people or real outsiders and outliers. He didn't do that. So you kind of could go, okay, I can see how it's shaping up. The people that are being floated already around Trump are people that we've seen associated with him already publicly. But I'm hearing Newt Gingrich's name floated. You probably are too. Chris Christie. Rudy Giuliani. Folks, this is not draining the swamp, as they say in that campaign. This is refilling the swamp with old swamp water. I mean, these are the Republicans of 92, 94, 1996 coming back from the dead. When you wonder if Trump is going to follow through on promises, especially those wonderful third-party ones I like the most, if those people are around, then he is surrounding himself not just with people who won't support him on that, but people that you could reliably count on to oppose that if someone else brought it to them. These are people who support those trade deals. These are, my goodness, the idea of a major change in foreign policy? Give me a break. So if you're a Trump supporter, you should look at the way this is already breaking and start counting the things he promised you that you're not going to get, probably. If you're a Trump hater and you're worried about all that stuff, you can probably take a little bit of solace in the fact that he's not surrounding himself with a bunch of guys you never heard of, or a bunch of women, well, probably not women, that you never heard of. The people he's surrounding himself have track records. They're horrible track records, in my opinion. But it's going to probably look more like a Republican administration than this unusual third-party populist guy who came out of nowhere because he had views that were different than the mainstream. If that theory holds true, well, you could expect some Supreme Court justices from the conservative side of the ledger. Bet you'll see some tax cuts, certainly on the wealthy. Probably an increase in defense spending. Get rid of Obamacare, certainly, although the way the costs and prices are going up on that, that might be popular. Probably see a decrease in banking regulations. Just what we need, right? I mean, you know, we never have any problem with that. Goodness gracious. And you might see an increase in the torturing and the taking off the gloves in the war on terror. But as I said, that would just put him in line with the last Republican administration. In terms of things like corruption and whatnot, well, there was a story in The Intercept the other day listing, it was all about the lobbyists that are working hard, crafting and putting together and working with his campaign. And they're the same people that are working with Clinton. So if the idea was we were going to bring in an outsider here and he was going to be free and clear of the corruptive influences of the lobbying and the Washington insiders, apparently those people have gotten to him already. So we will put that in the show notes, by the way, of the story if you want to read that. But I think it's still one of the top stories on there if you want to go to The Intercept and read it. If you were someone who was hoping that Trump was going to come in and drain the corruption swamp, doesn't look like it so far. I think it's pretty clear that if Trump turns around on a bunch of these things, on the people that elected him and gave him a chance because they thought politicians could be counted upon to pull the football away from him like Lucy and Charlie Brown, that maybe a guy from outside the political system wouldn't do that. If he starts to do that, do you know how angry those people are going to be? Do you know how much that's once again going to ratchet up where our system is right now? The feeling like nothing you do actually gets done what you were promised and what you voted for? Which brings me to the real message that I hope sinks in, but I would, considering my particular prejudices. So much of the anger out there right now is directed at fellow Americans who voted a way that you find repugnant. I went on the internet. I looked everywhere. I was reading the comments, and they're so hateful and spiteful, and there are no doors open to working with anybody, and it's folks, the anger that I'm reading online is poisonous. It's poisonous. What kind of country are you going to have with this long term? And the worst part is it solves nothing. Being angry to the point of, you know, fist fights with other people who are your countrymen solves nothing and divides us more. How about we unite over something that we can all agree on and push for that before the next time comes up when we have presidential choices we can't stand? What I would say to these people that are so angry at the people that voted the wrong way, whichever way that may be, is that your anger is misdirected. Most of those people, isn't this interesting, but most of those people, given another option, would have taken it. Someone from their own party especially. They didn't enthusiastically support the candidate. You're holding them accountable for holding their nose and voting for what they saw as the lesser of two evils. We could all be working together to see that we come up with a way that we don't have to vote for the lesser of two evils anymore. But in order to do that, you have to take on the current system we have. Now, remember, this is not a system designed in the Constitution. These two parties are not a part of the government. These are private entities, and yet they control access to who gets the White House, and they continually give us people we don't like and who don't follow through with their promises. Do we have to stand for that? You can get mad at your countryman for voting wrong, but even if he voted the other way, the country's not doing that great. Well, what kind of changes could we make, Dan? Well, listen, they're long shots, but they're the kind of thing that become possible in times that are extraordinary, as we said earlier in this conversation. It's extraordinary times. You have to take your blinders off and say, well, that would never happen because something that just happened is something that never could have happened. President-elect Trump is president-elect, right? All bets are off. Shoot for the moon. What do you got to lose? You know, things seem to be on a roll that way right now. It might be a sign of the times, don't you think? Radical thinking starts to make sense when times become radical. I mean, for example, if my numbers are right, and they may not be, I think Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and of course she lost the Electoral College. That's not that unusual. But once again, we're left asking whether or not the Electoral College really makes sense in the modern 21st century world. Shouldn't we just be going on who gets the most votes? And you think to yourself, well, that's a really tough thing to change. Yeah, times might have to be really unusual to get that changed. Bing. Okay, there's one thing maybe you could think of. What about the idea that would turn the lesser of two evil argument totally on its head? We mentioned none of the above in a show or two ago, which, by the way, Nevada has. That's not that unbelievable. I mean, we have a state that actually does that. But how about preference voting? A lot of people like this idea where you rank your choices. And that way, you can always say, well, listen, if Bernie Sanders doesn't get in, I want my vote to go to Hillary Clinton. But if I can vote for both of them, I want Bernie more. That is a thing right there that completely revolutionizes the system. Usually you can't imagine a change that big happening. We live in interesting times, though, don't we? So when I see protesters out in the street, as I did last night on all the news stations, and I wondered what they were protesting for. I mean, I'm glad they're out there. Maybe they're just getting their protesting muscles warmed up, teaching the youngins how to do it. Always good to get into shape for that. I get it. I'm pro-protest. But I kept wondering what they wanted other than to show how upset they were about things. If you want to protest for something, and maybe something you can get, you know, conservative people on the other side of the ledger to agree with you on, is let's start talking about ways so we don't have to vote for the lesser of two evils forever. Because as I think you can tell, because it's pretty common sense, isn't it, that eventually you end up at the same destination, no matter how slowly or quickly, you know, your voting takes you there, right? An evil destination one way or the other. Let's fix what's broken here. You're not going to fix the voting patterns of your countrymen, but you might fix the system that gives them such poor choices to make as well. Now, I do want to point out how deliciously joyful it is to read columns like the one I read by David Brooks yesterday. And I'm amazed that David Brooks, who I saw on television as an analyst working the election till like 3 a.m, I don't know how he got home, penned this article, and got it at the New York Times the next day, but he did. And of course, you know, he being an insider to the elite Beltway sort of a group, I mean, he's appalled at the whole thing. But then he wrote this. Now, I can always count on David Brooks to shoot down the idea of third parties and independence because it's, you know, there's too many systemic roadblocks and you're just dreaming. Pick one of the two parties and like everybody else. But of course, now that he doesn't really have a party, he likes third parties. He wrote this from the middle of the piece, quote, "Personally, I've always disdained talk of a third party, mostly because the structural barriers against such parties are so high, no matter how scintillatingly attractive they seem in theory. But it's becoming clear that the need for a third party outweighs even the very real barriers. The Republican Party, he writes, will probably remain the white working class party, favoring closed trade, closed borders, and American withdrawal abroad. The Democratic Party, meanwhile, is increasingly dominated by its left-slash-Sanders wing, which offers its own populism of the left. There has to be a party for those who are now homeless, he writes. There has to be a party as confidently opposed to populism as populists are in favor of it." End quote. Well, David, I'm glad you've seen the light. All you had to do was not have a party to vote for before you started seeing how much you liked the idea of a third party or an independent candidate. Maybe you could call your third party the Federalists or Optimists. Finally, let me throw in a little side benefit to all this, and I don't know if you're going to like to hear this or not. There's a dynamic that we've talked about on this program before. The dynamic involves holding a president accountable for something if that president is a member of your own party. I mean, I'm actually excited about Donald Trump being president in one sense because all of a sudden I can gain back all these allies who were Democratic Party candidate supporters on constitutional civil liberties questions and such. I mean, when Barack Obama did things with drones, that those same folks would have torn George W. Bush apart for doing, they often sat on their hands because they didn't want to undercut their president. Now, that is certainly not something that is unique to Democrats. It's a human thing. Republicans do it too. You don't want to undercut your guy, so you mute your criticism sometimes, even if it's something you feel strongly about. Well, some of the greatest defenders in this country of these civil liberties causes that are important to me, you know, align with the Democrats. They have been too quiet for two terms. It will be nice to have them back on my side. So I know you're angry. I know the Trump supporters were angry too. I mean, this was an angry election. It's an angry result. But let's use this anger. And I'm Trump supporters, you people too, because you're going to be pretty mad if he starts Giuliani-ing and Gingrifying his policies all of a sudden and starts looking like you voted for Marco Rubio. When that happens and you're mad, realize that the only people that can really help you are the people that voted the other way two nights ago. The reason you should not misdirect your anger at your countrymen is because if we're going to solve these problems, we need each other. I know that's a radical thing to say nowadays, right? The idea that you could work with the fellow Americans, the people that you're each calling each other such horrible names on the internet right now. But unless this secession move in a place like California or something comes off, we're stuck with each other. There's some things we can change if you're willing to reach across the divide. And if you find it hard in this post-election season with the wounds still fresh and everybody so upset with their fellow man to think about working in tandem with them for any collective goal, bear in mind that a great many of the people who voted the way that you can't stand that they did wouldn't have voted that way if they weren't stuck in this lesser of two evils dynamic as well. A lofty but doable goal for the next 4 years would be to see if we couldn't figure out a way and enact changes so that none of us ever had to do that again. That makes this country better and helps all of us. And that ought to be the criteria we move forward with whatever we're talking about. I couldn't help but notice while browsing Audible's website tonight looking for a book to recommend to you how many books they had on Donald Trump. If you're in the market for a Donald Trump audiobook, consider going to Audible now and picking one up. They have the pro-Trump books, they have the anti-Trump exposés, and they have several books by, allegedly, the man himself. So if you're interested in that, might want to head on over to Audible. Audible, of course, is a leading provider of premium digital audio entertainment and information, audiobooks, and a whole lot more. Their content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, things like news, comedy, a whole lot more from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. The categories offered are wide and vast. Everything from business topics, the classics, fiction, history, romance, mystery, sci-fi and fantasy, self-development, all kinds of educational offerings, comedy offerings, multimedia content you might not expect, news and periodicals certainly. And while I was looking at all of those Trump books to possibly recommend, I couldn't help but notice something that maybe you could call a more macro look at some of our dynamics today, a distant mirror, Barbara Tuchman might refer to it as. It's a book I happen to like quite a bit by Tom Holland. It's called Rubicon, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Republic. If you don't see a few similarities, some warning signs perhaps, and yes, let's be honest, some key differences between the ancient Roman Republic and our current one, well, maybe you're not looking hard enough. Why don't you check it out? If you haven't read it yet, it's one of the fun historical books to read. Holland has a way of picking up on the very human things through the distant ages that even resonate with us today, seem to provide some lessons for all time, if you will. And don't forget, if you go to audible.com/Dan Carlin and sign up for a 30-day trial membership, you can get a free audiobook when you do. Maybe consider that as a potential way to download your copy of Rubicon and hear if you don't see a few things that resonate with you and a few things maybe to continue to look out for on the horizon. Remember, that's audible.com/Dan Carlin.
You want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.